Eric Hurd has the first question.
We seem to have more books, tapes, messages on marriage than ever. And yet when we look at the statistics in the church, the divorce rate inside the church is seemingly no different than inside the church. What are we doing wrong as a church when it comes to marriage, divorce, and remarriage?
I'd say we're all depraved, and people just are not walking humbly with the Lord, learning what God's Word says, and they're not applying it. Our generation is getting more and more evil. It's in the church. I mean, the things that people in the church are doing to pastors is unreal. In fact, Chuck, you know, could give you an illustration that we heard just this past week. But I think it basically is just Satan's on the loose, and he's getting a hold of a lot of hearts of those that are within the church, and that's why we see what we do.
I think, Eric, there is a lack of authentic modeling of what life needs to be, ought to be. We're busier than we've ever been. I don't think there'd be many that would stand to their feet saying, I come from a model home. So model homes are hard to find. An inability to forgive, to work through conflicts, leads to this. Picking up the world system, which is everywhere. You know, people say, well, it's big in California. Hey, it's big everywhere. That problem is everywhere. It's not endemic to this area. It's everywhere. Also, there is not a lot of proactive help to prepare couples realistically for what they're stepping into. And the church ought to be able to do better than anyone. By that I mean spiritual advisors, those who are adept in spiritual formation, the cultivation of hearts that blend together, if I may get this technical, the right testing done to help couples know that, you know, you've got these things that need to be dealt with before we will do the ceremony. We want to be sure that you really can work in harmony with each other. All of that. These are all general answers, and it's a hard question to answer real specifically, but along with what was said here, I would add those things. Yes, sir.
My name is Dan McMillan. I'm currently on a sabbatical from my church in the Northwest, and I'm enjoying some time down here with
Wonderful.
Family.
We're currently envious of you.
Oh, I'm sure you are. I do have two questions, if I can ask two of you. One is the question of success. In today's world, it seems like there's a lot of emphasis about what it looks like to be a successful pastor with
yes.
a megachurch syndrome.
Yes.
The idea that you're not doing something right if yes. you're in a small church. I serve in a kind of a rural community in a small church.
Right.
And there's always that pressing sense of, you know, will I ever be successful?
Sure.
Based upon what you read, what you see.
Sure.
That's one question. You know, how would a pastor deal with that? And the second question is that I've heard often, and even my father told me this, that, and he was a pastor, he said you can never really get close to the people in your church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of gone through a lot of ministry with not having close friends in my church.
Huh.
And the idea was you can't show favoritism towards mm-hmm. a person in your church, so just don't get close. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. One of the great things you can teach yourself, Dan, is to think very little, if ever, about success. You have to train yourself to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with size. If size is the secret of success, the cults are successful. The Roman Church is still the most successful of the denominations. I'm so weary of the size emphasis I could vomit. And so I would urge you to train yourself. And I trained myself. You say, well, that's easy because you had big church. I never longed for a big church. I've done big church stuff. I think there are many, many benefits in a larger church. But one of them is not to tell people you're not successful. I would urge you to become a good student of writers like Richard Foster. Those who will help bring you back. Biola's turning out a number of great things, and I'd say this anywhere. I'm not blowing smoke on Biola. I love what they're doing in spiritual formation. And I think much of what comes out of there is really worth your time. It'll help shape that. And the more you're shaped there, really, the less you'll think about and even concern yourself with success. In the process, you have to educate your board, because boards are often enamored of it. And they gauge growth and call that success. So we got to be careful there. Now, having said that, there's nothing wrong with growth. There's nothing wrong with growth. I just don't believe it ought to be manipulated. I don't believe we ought to do what would cause us someday to come back and say, because we did that, we grew. Usually we don't know why we grow. I like it that I can't explain why 500 and some odd people, however many you are, showed up today. I don't call that successful. I call that surprising. And I'm not trying to be silly about this. But I've lived long enough to say I've dealt with guys that have gotten caught in that trap. And it's awfully secular. It's awfully carnal. Before long, you really are relying on a lot of stuff that isn't prompted by the Spirit. I liked your other question better, but I forgot it.
It was about building friendships with your... Oh, yeah. With your congregation, your people.
You know what? We don't follow that rule either. You know, the problem with us, we're not great models of all the big rules that are going on out there. We have been very close to congregational members. However, you got to be wise, and you got to pick them carefully. You certainly would want to limit it to a small number. I mean, when we talk about friendships, I think of concentric circles and the intimate group. It's probably not going to be more than three couples. You're unusual if you've got more than three couples that where you're really intimate with each other, where there are just no secrets, there's just nothing. But they have to have the understanding, and they have to have no agenda. So you take your time as you choose. It's like choosing an accountability group. You just don't go out and pick out guys whose names are, you know, start with the letter B, or you like this guy because he likes the same sport you like. You really are careful in selecting someone you're going to be accountable to, because in accountability, there's vulnerability, and in vulnerability, there's scandal or the potential for scandal. So I would say you could be close friends with those in the church. Not a lot of them, but you certainly can have some of them. I think some benefit comes in having friendships outside the church at the same time. You want to add something more to that?
Well, for me, I really look at a person's heart before selecting them as a friend. The very first criteria is obedience and a genuine desire to know what God's word says, and then just to help me put into words a path that is going to lead to complete obedience to whatever God has said about this particular thing. My closest friends are in the church. They always have been. And I've never had a problem with that.
I think it's important that you not use them as sermon illustrations, you know? I think, just as you want them to be confidential, you need to be. You've got to really train yourself. If they're going to be close friends, but they wouldn't be good board members, they ought not be board members. Or if they are board members, as we've had the experience, we've got to be careful that you don't listen more to them than you do to another. It's a discipline thing. It's a safer thing to do what your dad said, but I'm saying I've not found that it's essential to be there, but you've got to be wise in it. I hope that helps, Dad.
Good, thank you.
That's a pretty general answer. Yes, sir.
Chuck, I want to address a question to you. Dan's question was marvelous, talking about the issue of being really close to other men.
Yes.
In the church as a pastor, but
right.
We all know that men in our society are still largely friendless, and that men in the church have the same problem.
Right.
What can pastors do to call their men up higher, to call them to really be part of the church, not just going along with their wives?
One of the greatest things that can be done, I've already hit on, is the matter of modeling. Men are interesting creatures. We aren't usually changed by words.
We really are.
Yeah. I said.
She agreed too quickly.
We are We are more moved by models and by example than we are by a talk or things that come out of our mouths. I think men need to see commitment in our lives. I think it takes time. I would urge all of us to guard against pushing people. We can challenge them. We can model for them. But I've found very little accomplished by pushing someone faster than they're ready to come. Sometimes you don't know the reason they're not ready to commit. Sometimes you don't know what's holding them back. If we knew the heartaches or the secrets in the lives of those sitting around us today, our mouths would drop open. We're all struggling with stuff, deep stuff. Cynthia and I are going through a situation right now in our very family that's to the place where we can hardly go to bed at night without tears. Now, that causes us to have certain reluctance in areas until we get that resolved. And so that area has to be addressed as well. We're fearfully and wonderfully made, the psalmist put it very well. And I think there's a lot more to that than we have given thought to.
Specifically, Chuck, what a corollary question, what do you think pastors can do specifically to stimulate men to fellowship with each other, to do mentoring, to connect with each other?
Sure. We have to give opportunities for them to gather. And we have to vary those with areas of need. In our church, we happen to have a man named Steve Farrar, who's really good on his feet. He's a wonderful friend of ours and has been for years. Steve ministers to our men. They'll do retreats together. And Steve is just a natural guy to mix, to have the mix occur. And I think when you've got opportunity like that made available, men will come to be a part of it. But I have to say again, it will not really click. It will not really land with full force until there's this sense of confidence and trust in the gathering that they're with. And that has to be cultivated. It just takes time.
Good morning, Pastor Chuck. My name's Andy. And the question I have for you, I don't want to necessarily put you on the spot, but I want to learn. When Cynthia was going through those years of depression, what did you do that you felt was helpful or not helpful? Just generally or specifically?
Those are some of the hardest years of my life. My problem was I was on every Sunday. And I didn't do real well from just at all times. Sometimes I was disillusioned. Sometimes I was afraid she'd take her life. And I'd walk in on it. If you've never known that, you have no idea what I've just said. But if you have, you don't need any further explanation. She was so low. She was so, at the end, so hopeless that it affected me. And then I have to tell you, I also had to come to terms with the fact that I'm part of the problem. I was part of the problem. And I remember her saying to me, standing in the kitchen in our little house, 10 Bruce Road, across the street from the church in New England, in Massachusetts. She said, I don't want you to tell people we're partners anymore because we're not partners. I said, yeah, we are. She said, no, we're not. I said, yeah, we're partners. We are partners. We're not partners. Stop telling people we're partners. You live your world and I live mine. And I mean, it got, and then she walked upstairs and, you know, what wives do. And I sat there, and we had two little kids at the time, and I'd put them both to bed. I remember standing at the kitchen sink finishing the dishes and looking at my reflection. It was night, and I looked at my reflection in the glass, and I thought, you fool. She's telling you the truth. So I went upstairs, opened the door. And I sat down on the bed and I said, you're right. You're right. And she said, you know, I'm getting all this help. I'm getting, you know, as best I can. I'm trying to figure out what life's about. We've come from these backgrounds we've come from. I can't make it alone. I don't want it to be like it is. And I said, I don't either. It's the beginning of a 4-year journey that got us through the rest of the couple of years in New England and then into the first couple of years at Irving. And you know what? The best things we learned, we couldn't share. Because back in those days, when you went through stuff like this, you're sick. And it's more than sick. You're heartbroken. You're struggling. You're vulnerable. How can you tell people that? But you know what? It was the making of our lives. It really was. As hard as it was, and as painful as it was, when I realized that, if I can't pull it together here, I don't have any business exporting it. And I remember going through some very, very difficult and gut-wrenching sessions where I had to face the fact that I didn't love her for who she was. And she's so much that I missed. So I began to see the value, the depth. And I began to realize I need her. Because she said to me in our argument, she said, you never say you need me. You don't need me. Anyway, fast forward about 15, 18 years, I don't know, maybe 20. And I'm in a group and I'm sitting out here and Cynthia's up here. And she's talking about the ministry of Insight for Living, which she runs. She's the reason it's successful. You don't want me running it. You want her running it. She made the comment just as an afterthought. She said, because Chuck and I are partners in this, we are able to do so and so. I want to go, yes! I mean, everybody just sitting there. And I thought, how great is that? It just came out. And I thought, it's like a friend of mine who married this woman. And Brenda said to him, when they married, she said, I don't know that I love you. And she'd gone through a horrendous background, rapes and all kinds of horrible things. And he said, for 14 years, she never laughed. And she said to him, when they married, she said, I want you to know before we marry, I'm not sure if I love you. But I like being with you. And he said, you're worth it. You're worth it. I want to marry you. So they married. And he said, I remember riding along and something happened and she throws her head back and laughs. He said, I want to just pull off the side of the road and just dance because I'm seeing this. That's the feeling I had that day. And since then, since we hammered it out and worked it through and all, there has been that sense of oneness. Not that I can't do something unless she's there or she can't do something unless I'm given her counsel on it and all of that. It's that we value each other. We listen to each other. And we forgive each other. We argue. We go at it. We address things. But we realize we're better together. Because I said to Carter, you don't want me. You want Cynthia. He said, oh, I know. He understood. He understood. Plus, you know what? I'm more accountable when she's here. My stories are a lot more exaggerated when she's not here.
My name's Sherry.
Hi, Sherry.
Hello. I had the privilege of serving with you and Cynthia on staff. We served in youth ministry with you. And one of the greatest gifts you ever gave me as a pastor's wife was an intervention in which you called me out and said, what is wrong with you? Why have you kept the secret in your marriage, which ultimately led to a divorce? Thank you for that gift. And my question to you and Cynthia is, to the pastor's wives here who at times are tempted to keep a secret or to keep in places of pain, as Cynthia, you so wonderfully shared with us, what would you have to say to us as women? Where do we go? What do we do? How do we come forth and be honest about what's happening so that the enemy doesn't take a stronghold in our lives and in our marriages?
That is such a simple question Cynthia's going to. I'm not making light of it.
I know.
That is a profound question.
And I'm grateful to you.
I know your story. Okay.
Yeah.
And knowing that, I'm going to give you briefly an illustration that represents how we now handle stuff as opposed to how we probably, I don't say we mishandled it, but we were not as upfront. We've learned in ministry that when bad stuff is going on, you need to take care of it. Before you can build anything, you've got to be sure all the soil is clean that you're going to build upon. And in your situation where it wasn't, you've got to be honest about it. Honest with the other members of the staff to tell what it is. You wish that and it was a moral issue, you wish in situations like that that people would change, that they would say, I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to walk humbly with God. I'm going to love kindness. Micah 6:8. A really good preacher has a series of messages on that that you really need to hear. But it's the truth. It is the truth.
Let me add to this that it's a very risky thing to do what we just described. It's because of that risk we don't do it. You have to be willing to risk even that. We have a situation we're aware of, very well aware of, where the wife finally said, that's enough. Can't keep this a secret any longer. Happened to be a pastor's wife. And their marriage is now broken up. To her, it was worth whatever to live free of the lies. We have another former board member of a ministry we've been involved in. Truth came out, how addicted he was to porn. And she found out, and she addressed it, and she exposed it.
She communicated it to us.
She told
us. We took him off the board, and we told the board why he was being kicked off the board.
And because he would not break with it.
Wouldn't.
And he put her down. He was in a very powerful position in his work. And it was exposed. I don't know where he is today, but it has totally captured his life. She has remarried and is wonderfully happy in a new relationship. She could live with this secret no longer, that kind of thing. But this is tough stuff. This is tough love. You've got to think about this. You've got to realize this could turn on me. And that's the tough part of it. But remember what I said, the greatest gift you give your congregation? Authenticity. Authenticity. When I die, there is no closet with a skeleton. There is nothing that's going to be found on my computer that would embarrass my wife and bring reproach to Christ. Because I'm accountable to a body of men who see what I look at on the computer, et cetera, et cetera. I have a good friend who, and this is it. This is it, Jim. We're through. I promise. Real good friend named Bob Garippa. Bob was for years at Bethany Bible in Phoenix. He's now at the seminary working dean of students. And Bob's from an Italian family and strong paternal leadership. And he said, boy, a lot of brothers and sisters, and they just adore their dad. And he said, I was perhaps among the closest to him. And I just learned so much from him. And one day he drops dead, just dies. The family gets together, and they said, okay, somebody's got to go through his personal effects. It's you, Bob. Bob says to me with tears hanging in his eyelids, I didn't want to do that. You know why he didn't. And he said, my great fear was that I would uncover some secret, some love note from a woman, some picture from an affair, something on the hard drive. And he said, I spent not quite 2 weeks in my father's study. I went through everything. And he said, when I finished, all alone, I said, thank you, Lord, for integrity. That is the way to die. That's the way to go. Thanks for giving us a chance to open that door.
I want to just make a comment. All of you have probably studied Titus 3:10. And when it comes to an elder board, I think this is very important. It says, reject a factious man after a first and second warning, knowing that such a man is perverted and is sinning, being self-condemned. And what this means is you don't let stuff go on month after month after month.
Right.
If a person is an angry person and it happens to be the chairman of your board or a member of your board, you handle it. You handle it immediately. And what happens if they don't change? You send them on your way. You reject them. He has another good sermon on that as well.
You know what? If we have made one mistake more often than any other in ministry, it's waiting too long deal with people that have no business controlling ministries. I have a little passion about that.
That's right.
Well, thank you very, very much, Chuck and Cynthia. Let's just
You're welcome.